Even in conflict, there are rules. And if you break those rules, you commit war crimes.
The military-industrial complex is so pervasive in our country. It is the octopus that has sucked in everything.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we featured two high-ranking officials who are shaping the global outcry against war. The Gambia's Fatou Bensouda is a deputy prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. Colonel Anne Wright, a former U.S. Army officer and diplomat, is an outspoken opponent of U.S. military policy. Women Rising Radio produced this program.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying.
In 2002, the International Criminal Court officially began its work worldwide after a decade of painstaking planning and diplomacy. One of its founding mothers is Fatou Bensouda, elected as a deputy prosecutor of the court. Mrs. Bensouda sees her work at the ICC and on behalf of humanitarian law as the realization of a childhood goal.
From a very young age, all I wanted to do was to do law. Even before I thought of becoming a lawyer, I always had this deep sense of justice must be done, even as a child. And one thing that became clear to me was that there were not many female lawyers, especially female lawyers who could deal with female issues and gender issues and child issues. I thought I would have perhaps a sensitive ear to that because of my gender. I remember that when I was the justice minister in the Gambia, one of the first things that I decided to change was the sentencing for rape. The punishment that was given for rape or indecent assault, assaulting children who are below the age of 16, I think these penalties were really very mild, very trivial. Previously, it was 7 years or so. But now, if you're found guilty of this offense, you can be sentenced up to a life sentence. And if you have this deep sense of saying that things have to change, you really just have to see what you can do about it.
Fatou Bensouda's defense of the rights of women and children in the Gambia grew into a wider vision of human rights and humanitarian law. And after rising to the posts of Attorney General and Minister of Justice in the Gambia, Mrs. Bensouda was named legal advisor and trial attorney for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda.
The ICTR, which is the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, was set up in Tanzania and also in Rwanda. And you will find that they have done quite well in the sense that they have set up very important precedents in the law, in international humanitarian law. For example, it was in the Rwanda tribunal in the Akayesu case that rape was for the first time declared as genocide. Wow, this is big. And also as crime against humanity. And the ICC has codified this law or this jurisprudence, and it is now in our statute, the Rome Statute. Rape can be seen as both genocide and crime against humanity. Also, with respect to the Rwanda tribunal, it was there for the first time that a prime minister was brought before the court. I mean, that's a very high position. So it has set some milestones which courts that come after it and the ICC has been able to follow and emulate. ICC was established when the international community said impunity has to stop. The crimes that are being committed against innocent people, massive crimes, crimes of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. This has to stop, or those who continue to perpetrate these crimes have to be held accountable. And we have seen over and over and over again this thing happens, even though the international community keeps on saying never again. Today, as we are speaking, it is happening in Darfur. It is happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's happening in Afghanistan. But the difference now is that those who perpetrated will be held accountable. This is why the ICC was set up. Africa has played a very major role in getting the ICC to be established. And I have represented my country, the Gambia, during the negotiations for the establishment of the ICC. And maybe my contribution to that was that during the negotiations, I was also able to talk to other African countries, exchange ideas, and try to convince each other that this was a good thing that can happen to the world, that can happen for human rights, that can happen for international humanitarian law. And today, if you look at the participation of African countries in the ICC, Africa is the single continent with the most ratifications. 30 African countries have signed and ratified the Rome Statute. And I think this shows the resolve in Africa that impunity has to be a thing of the past, that human rights has to be respected, that golden exiles and amnesties should come to an end. This was really the spirit that we had in Rome when the ICC was established.
In 2004, Uganda referred the first major case to the ICC against a group called the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA. The LRA has burned, pillaged, raped, and killed for over 20 years of relentless war in Uganda. Just a year after the LRA case was opened, the ICC issued arrest warrants against the LRA's top leaders. Following this success, the ICC got a request from the president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo to investigate the violence in his country, the DRC. And in 2006, Congolese rebel Thomas Lubanga Diallo became the first person taken into custody at the ICC in The Hague and formally charged with war crimes. The ICC also has a case in the Sudan investigating the violence in Darfur at the request of the United Nations. Recently, the ICC issued an arrest warrant against Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, citing his personal responsibility for the genocide and war crimes in Darfur. President al-Bashir has refused to cooperate with the ICC, seeking the protection of powerful regional and UN allies to derail the ICC mandate against him.
The Bashir arrest warrant is still outstanding. It has not been executed. It's not an easy shot. We have to admit it requires a lot of coordination, a lot of cooperation, and a lot of understanding why these warrants were issued against President al-Bashir. And we are doing this, so we will see. What is most important for me is that we have been able to, in very difficult circumstances, investigate without going to Darfur, because the Sudanese government is not cooperating with the ICC. And we had to, under difficult circumstances, investigate, you know, going to 17 different countries, over 70 missions, to be able to conduct these investigations. And I think it was really a high point when we presented the evidence. I think it always gives me great satisfaction that we have been able to achieve this. But what has really been a highlight of our work in the ICC is when we were able to get the first person arrested and transferred to the court for the first time. And at the end of it all, I always say that whether the person, Lubanga, is convicted or not convicted, I am happy that the ICC has been able to bring attention to this crime, to show how serious this crime is, how much it affects a whole generation of young children, as young as 9 years, given guns, turned into killers, turned into porters, made to fight wars. I think the fact that we have been able to bring this to the attention of the international community is already a big highlight for me.
In the 1990s, U.S. support was crucial in the creation of the International Criminal Tribunals for both Rwanda and Yugoslavia. But the Bush administration turned its back on the ICC, waging an aggressive campaign against it. The U.S., China, and Russia have refused to become members to the ICC. All three nations have cited concerns about limits on their sovereign power. Some experts speculate that these three military giants may fear being brought before the court for arming, financing, and helping to instigate many of the conflicts raging around the globe. Meanwhile, Deputy Prosecutor Bensouda remains hopeful that they will soon become member states.
I think one thing that you need to note is that today, 110 countries are members. They've signed and ratified the Rome Statute and are members of the ICC. This is well over half the membership of the United Nations. I cannot castigate any country for having their own policies of why they have not joined the ICC. I can only say that we continue to encourage countries to sign and ratify the Rome Statute and also to say, yes, there has to be an end to impunity wherever it happens. But even in the instance where crimes that fall within the jurisdiction of the ICC are committed on the territory of a state party, the ICC has jurisdiction. And this means that, just to give an example, if a crime were to be committed on a state party by a non-state party, as long as it happens on the territory of a state party, we can investigate those crimes, whether you have signed, whether you have not signed. So we aim for universality. But it does not also mean that the hands of the ICC are completely tied.
Deeply aware of the criminality of war and its devastating effects worldwide, Fatou Bensouda is devoting her life to promoting peace by eliminating war's criminal violence through legal means.
Of course, in an ideal situation, if there are problems, we want to sit around a table and talk about it and sort out those problems. This is ideal. But unfortunately, this is not what happens. So I'm not saying war is a good thing. Of course, it's not a good thing, but it happens. In reality, it happens. You know, whether we like it or not, people go into conflict for various reasons. But even in conflict, there are rules. And if you break those rules, you commit war crimes. And there cannot be peace without justice. And justice does not mean just taking someone to a tribunal and locking them up. We owe it to ourselves and we owe it to our communities to ensure that justice becomes part of whatever negotiations or initiatives we take to settle conflicts, to be able to bring about stability and peace. And one thing I want to point out is that it is women and children who bear the brunt of these conflicts. And not all of us can be prosecutors. We have different callings. But I believe that in whatever calling you are, there is something that you can do for the victims of crime, especially for women and children. There is something that you can do. Even by talking about it, by bringing attention to it, by sometimes coming together in groups and looking for something to do for these victims of these crimes is already something. So I think one thing that we should not say is, I cannot do anything. That should be out of the question. Oh, what can I do? No, we all can do something, however small. And it is those small, small efforts that we put together that materializes into something big.
Children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight. As the innocent die, you rulers carry the shame. And if we stand idly by, we share in the blame. Children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight.
imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for.
Colonel Anne Wright was serving in the U.S. military and the State Department when she made one of the most important decisions in her life. She chose to resign from her diplomatic post to protest Bush administration war policy and to wage a very public battle against it. Her resignation reached the desk of Secretary of State Colin Powell on March 19, 2003, one day before the U.S. invaded Iraq. Her letter was published on the internet, and she received 400 letters of support from people in the U.S. military and diplomatic corps. Since then, Colonel Wright has spoken out against U.S. foreign policy, headlined conferences, appeared as a TV commentator, and joined anti-war protests. The former Army colonel now keeps a collection of arrest bracelets from her many acts of civil disobedience. How did a high-ranking commander become an outspoken critic of the U.S. military? Was she a wild-eyed radical in her youth? To the contrary, Anne Wright says she had an ordinary upbringing and a long career with the Army.
I came from a Midwest family. I grew up in Arkansas, and being in the military was not a family tradition particularly, and I really didn't even think about joining the military until I was ending my college career and was faced with what was I going to do. And I'd been trained to be a teacher, a very honorable profession, but I didn't want to be a teacher. I didn't want to hang out with all those little kids. I didn't want to be a homemaker. I didn't want to be a secretary. I didn't want to be a nurse. And those were kind of the big four back in the 60s. I wanted to travel. I wanted to go see the world. I ended up staying not just 1 or 2 years, but 29 years in the military. It provided for me an opportunity to travel, which was my number one goal. And then it started getting me into some very interesting places and doing some interesting things. And in my entire federal government career, including the military, I'd worked under 8 different presidential administrations, starting with Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George Bush the First, Clinton, Bush the Second. And there were plenty of policies in each one of those administrations that I personally didn't agree with. In fact, most federal workers don't. I mean, it's not like it's a mindless block of people out there that agree with every single crazy scheme that these presidents cook up. But, you know, if you're going to stay as a federal employee, you learn to hold your nose to a lot of policies. You learn to move out of policies that you don't agree with. That said, for me, the decision of the Bush administration to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States, that did not have a thing to do with 9/11, and without the authorization of the UN Security Council, for me as a diplomat sitting out in Mongolia, and I had just come from 6 months in Afghanistan, I'd helped reopen the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. So I was hoping that the presence of even the modest number of U.S. troops that we had there could be used as an opportunity to help rebuild schools, rebuild clinics, rebuild some roads so that farmers could get their crops to market. There was a lot that could be done in a very short amount of time. And then to focus on Iraq just didn't make a bit of sense. So I was getting up every morning in Mongolia at 2 and 3 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. And writing my concerns about what was happening and trying to do as much reading as I could to see, make sure I didn't miss anything. And over a period of time, the stack of papers just grew and grew and grew. And, you know, it was like a foot tall. And as the drumbeat to war kept getting stronger and stronger, ultimately I decided that I had to resign. There was no way I could see myself serving in the Bush administration as a career diplomat, trying to justify to the people of Mongolia, U.S. foreign policy. I resigned to free myself so I could speak as a private citizen, using my career in the military and the State Department as a basis on which to speak, but to criticize what the Bush administration was doing.
While the United States was digging itself deeper and deeper into the quagmire of the war in Iraq, and as its leaders earned worldwide scorn over the torture and human rights violations in the military prisons at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Abu Ghraib, Colonel Anne Wright was becoming an outspoken critic of these abusive practices.
It was astounding to me to see how the Bush administration totally threw out the Geneva Conventions when Alberto Gonzalez said, "The Geneva Conventions, oh, a quaint piece of paper." I mean, the people in the military were horrified about this because the civilian leadership of our country were throwing out the protections for our own military and substituting something that was very, very dangerous. But, you know, just because the government signs away international laws that says we're not going to apply them doesn't relieve that administration of responsibility for it. I fully believe that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice have to be held accountable in a court of law for abrogating our domestic law and our international law. And ultimately, I feel confident we will hold them accountable. We just have to keep plowing ahead on it because these guys are, they're war criminals. They really are war criminals. And I'm an equally critical observer and commentator on what the Obama administration is doing, which is essentially continuing Bush's war in Iraq on the same timetable, and they're remaining in Iraq for God knows how long, and going to increase the military operations in Afghanistan.
As the world faces very difficult economic times, with billions of people lacking even basic food, shelter, and health care, U.S. military spending has skyrocketed to an all-time high, nearly $1 trillion every year, 53% of the U.S. federal budget, and more than the military spending of the next 15 countries combined. Anne Wright has joined an increasingly vocal group of policy experts demanding that the U.S. military budget and the U.S. dependence on a military economy be severely cut back.
When the U.S. military has more military recruiters than we have U.S. diplomats, that gives you a little sense of how totally dominated our U.S. policies are by the U.S. military. Totally dominated. The Department of Defense is truly a shadow government. The military-industrial complex is so pervasive in our country. It is the engine of growth. It's the economic engine. That's where we have the largest military budget in the history of the world is under the Obama administration. It is humongous because it is the octopus that has sucked in everything. So we're still in the same situation, trying to find people who will run for office who then will have the power to change these things. I think we've been sorely disappointed by most of our members of Congress. You know, Dwight Eisenhower actually didn't say just the military-industrial complex. When you go back to his original statement, it was the military-industrial congressional complex, the three of them. And Congress is complicit in this, with the exception of, you know, just a very small, brave group of people, to include Barbara Lee. We have to have a true revolution. There are so few people that should be left in the U.S. Congress. I mean, you can count them on one hand.
Colonel Anne Wright is also deeply concerned about the mounting level of violence within the U.S. military's own ranks. She says military recruiters are not telling the truth about what it's like to be a soldier.
The military must be honest with young men and women about what they're getting into. They need to be honest that, yeah, there are wars going on. I mean, the number of recruiters that tell kids, oh, that war in Afghanistan, it's over. So many young kids are not so well informed, don't read the newspapers, don't know what's going on. They know they just need a job. They need to get off the streets. They need to get out of an abusive family environment. The recruiters don't say anything at all about the issue of violence within the military, where one in three women in the military are sexually assaulted or raped, where in a congressional hearing last summer, the deputy chief of staff for the Army said 10% of them were reported by guys. That means 280 guys were raped in the shower or a blanket party, gang raped by their own fellow members of their unit. And for those 280 to have come forward to say to their chain of command, this thing happened to me. You know, in that male, macho-dominated, aggressive society, that somebody's coming forward to say, they raped me. That's unbelievable. That is the tip of the iceberg. For 1 in 3 women, the reason most women don't report it is because the prosecution rates are laughable. Less than 8% of the cases in the military are ever prosecuted. If there are convictions, laughable punishments. 1 month confinement to base. Forfeiture of 1 month's pay. Very seldom do perpetrators of these crimes go to jail. Very seldom. And I think that we need to force the military to put a sign above every recruiting door. Warning, sexual assault, rape in the military, 1 in 3 women. We don't even know how many men. These kids need to be warned about that. And if you talk to them about it, I'll tell you what, that will change a lot of minds, as it well should. If this is a predatory organization that can't even control its own people within the organization, how in the hell do you think you can control them on a battlefield? So I'm grateful in many ways to the military because they did provide me an opportunity to go travel in the world, further education, jobs that were pretty interesting. But then you have to recognize that the whole thing is based on an institution that goes to kill people.
Women Rising Radio produced this program. Visit us at womenrisingradio.com. Stephanie Welch is production engineer, and I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.